This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Bob Edwards. 50 years ago this week, the Supreme Court heard arguments in 5 school desegregation cases. The cases came from South Carolina, Kansas, Virginia, Delaware, and the District of Columbia. But they were known under the general heading Brown versus the Board of Education. This was the second time the court was to hear arguments, the justices having been paralyzed with indecision the previous term, had ordered the cases re-argued. The legal question was whether the court was right in 1896 when it ruled that segregation of the races met the 14th Amendment's demand for equal protection of the law. NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Just weeks before the second round of arguments was scheduled to take place, fate intervened. Chief Justice Fred Vinson died in his sleep, prompting Justice Felix Frankfurter to make this remark to his law clerk, Frank Sander.
Frankfurter said, "This is the first time I've believed in God."
3 weeks after Vinson's death, President Eisenhower nominated the new Chief Justice. He was Earl Warren, a former district attorney, state attorney general, 3-term governor of California, and 1948 Republican nominee for Vice President of the United States. Compared to the dour Chief Justice Vinson, who'd seemed frozen by the segregation cases, Warren was a man so attuned to public consensus that the last time he ran for governor of California, he had the endorsement not only of the Republican Party, but the Democratic Party, too. As soon as Warren's booming voice was heard in the Supreme Court halls, says former law clerk Sander, it was clear that this tall, white-haired bear of a man was very different from the previous Chief Justice.
The clouds had lifted and the sun was shining.
Brown and its companion cases were re-argued over 3 days in December, and when the justices convened for their conference, there was an immediate and apparent change. In place of Vinson, who'd seemed unwilling to overturn the separate but equal doctrine of Plessy versus Ferguson, there now sat Warren, who left no doubt about where he stood. According to the notes kept by the other justices that are read here by actors, Warren began by saying the time for delay was over.
"The more I read and hear and think, the more I come to conclude that the basis of the principle of segregation rests upon the basic premise that the Negro race is inferior. That is the only way to sustain Plessy. If oral argument proved anything, the arguments of Negro counsel proved that they are not inferior. I don't see how we can continue in this day and age to set one group apart."
Joining Warren in firmly calling for an end to segregation were Justices Black, Douglas, Burton, and Minton. That left 4 others with some reservations. Frankfurter and Clark pointed out problems but indicated they were on board. But Justice Robert Jackson, who'd served as Attorney General in the Roosevelt administration and then as the chief prosecutor of Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg, had already begun writing a separate opinion.
"This is a political question. I don't know how to justify the abolition of segregation as a judicial act. If we have to decide this question, then representative government has failed. The problem is to make a judicial basis for a congenial political conclusion."
As for Justice Stanley Reed, a soft-spoken Kentucky New Dealer, he still said he planned to dissent. He returned from the conference to tell his law clerk, John Fassett,
"He said they have the votes and they plan to do it."
The Chief Justice, however, studiously avoided taking a vote. Warren's law clerk, Earl Pollack, says the Chief Justice wanted to keep things in a state of flux so that the issues could be talked through. Serving Warren well was that in Washington, a city of talkers, he was a listener, Earl Pollack.
"He had the capacity to take his time. He did not place his ego ahead of the task to be done."
In late February or early March, Warren finally took a vote, and according to his memoirs, it was unanimous. But big question marks still remained. Would Reed really go along? Would others file separate opinions? And there were pressures from the outside, too. In his memoirs, Warren described a conversation he had with President Eisenhower at a White House dinner.
"The president took me by the arm, and as we walked along, speaking of the southern states in segregation cases, he said, 'These are not bad people. All they are concerned about is to see that their sweet little girls are not required to sit in school alongside some big overgrown Negroes.'"
Warren was unfazed. He worked alone in his study on an opinion, writing in his clear longhand on a yellow legal pad. In May of 1954, the draft had been worked and reworked and was in final form to show to the other members of the court. After decades of delay, the speed of the process was now breathtaking. It was May 7th when Warren hand-delivered the opinions to the justices at the court, sending his law clerk to deliver Justice Hugo Black's copy to the Alabamian on the tennis court. To deliver Justice Jackson's copy, Warren made a trip to Doctor's Hospital, where Jackson was recovering from a heart attack. And finally, he made a fateful visit to Justice Stanley Reed, perhaps the last holdout. In the next week, some changes were made, but to a remarkable extent, the opinion was the same as Warren's first handwritten draft. On May 15th, the justices met for their Saturday conference and approved the opinion, agreeing to release it just 2 days later. At the court on Monday, few knew it would be a momentous day. At Doctor's Hospital, Justice Jackson, defying doctor's orders, got into a car for the trip to the court. He would be there as a show of unanimity. At noon, the justices emerged from behind the crimson curtains in the courtroom. Shortly thereafter, Chief Justice Earl Warren began reading his first major opinion for the court, as in this reenactment.
These cases come to us from the states of Kansas, South Carolina, Virginia, and Delaware.
He got to the key point where he said, "We hold," except he inserted into the opinion, when he read it, the word unanimously.
Jackson law clerk Barrett Prettyman.
And when he said the word unanimously, the entire courtroom went,
Sitting in the courtroom, Thurgood Marshall, who'd masterminded the NAACP's legal strategy, found himself locked in a stare with a man he had expected to dissent, Justice Stanley Reed. When Marshall heard the word unanimously, he nodded ever so slightly at Reed, and Reed nodded back. Marshall's joy at the outcome, however, would be short-lived. For the court put over for re-argument the question of how and on what timetable schools were to be desegregated. A year later, the court ordered school boards to act with, quote, all deliberate speed. But there was massive resistance in the South. Duke law professor Walter Dellinger was a 13-year-old white boy in school in Raleigh, North Carolina, in 1954. He remembers the day Brown was announced when the assistant principal came to the door of his classroom to talk to his teacher.
I'll always remember our teacher said, "Children, the Supreme Court has spoken. Next year, you'll go to school with colored children."
But they did not.
In fact, I was through high school, college, law school, and teaching Brown to law students before there was really an end to de jure segregation in the rural South.
Indeed, it wasn't until 1969 that the Supreme Court became so impatient with Southern intransigence that the court finally abandoned all deliberate speed. Yet even as school desegregation became a reality, so did white flight, and in most urban areas, resegregation. So, did Brown matter in the long run? Professor Dellinger.
Brown put an enormous moral question to the country, and in particular to the South, whereas segregation had merely been a fact about the universe as I was growing up, neither right nor wrong, but just something that was. That changed on May 17, 1954, when the court made it a moral proposition that segregation was immoral.
Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Photographs, documents, and more on the history of the Brown case are at npr.org.